Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone, and I'm going to be spending this Saturday with you inside your radio. And there's room in here for you, two guests, and a whole lot of phone calls. Now, I guarantee you're going to want to make a night of this, because I know I am, because there is no other show anywhere that's going to be as good as tonight's show. And I give you my personal guarantee on that. Coming up in the 11 o'clock hour, we got Daniel Pinchbeck, great mind, author, writer for Rolling Stone magazine. He's going to come on and talk about his new think tank project, the Center for Planetary Culture, and his work in developing a post-carbon civilization. And believe me, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And in the first hour, we're talking with Mitch Batros about a very strange phenomenon that's happening in Antarctica that you're going to want to hear about, because I think it's going to affect the whole world. We're going to dive right into that right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM on a Saturday night. And we're going to have Daniel Pinchbeck come up in the 11 o'clock hour. But first, we're going to talk about a strange phenomenon. Well, I think it's strange. Going on in the Earth. Now, I think about the weather a lot. I'm really fascinated by these stories that point out what's going on with birds and ice and ocean. I mean, I think it's because I'm a listener. I listen for a living. And the only way the Earth speaks is through weather. Sometimes it yells with an earthquake, but if there is a language of the Earth, it has to be the weather. So I like to listen to that too, because I think there's something more than just finding out when it's going to rain. I think you tap into something that expands your intuition. Anyway, it does for me. So when I heard about this story, I thought, well, we got to talk about this. It's in Antarctica, the land of ice. But dive below the West Antarctic ice sheet, and you'll find a fire as well in the form of subglacial volcanoes. That's right. Now, a new study finds by the geophysicist from the University of Texas at Austin is that there are these subglacial volcanoes and other geothermal hotspots that are contributing to the melting of the Thwaites Glacier. And that is a major river of ice, flows into Antarctica's Pine Island Bay, and it's just hemorrhaging ice. And what does that mean about the future of this continent? Mitch Batros joins us from Earth Changes TV. Mitch, what's your take on this?
Well, I think the science community is catching on. What's happened up until this more recent time, say 2011 is when I started to notice it, is the science community, very much like the medical community, had traditionally been segmented. Everybody was a specialist, and basically the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. NOAA had their focus on the ocean and the atmosphere, but they didn't go any further, and they didn't talk to NASA. NASA picked it up in the upper atmosphere and, of course, space, but the two disciplines never communicated, not until really in the last 3 years or 4 years. As a result, they missed a whole lot of connection. And kind of like what you were saying, that things do appear to have some correlation, and they certainly do in this case.
Yeah.
Regarding the what's going on in some call it the Thwaites, some people call it the Thwaites, it's all the same. In that whole region, actually not just in the South Pole, but also in the North Pole. Mm-hmm. And this huge swing of information began with the global warming theories and has more recently in the last 12 to 18 months has been corrected, that there's a lot more natural cyclical events that appear to be behind these weather changes, warming and cooling trends. Mm-hmm. Which is what's happening in the South Pole.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems like a natural phenomenon, of course, to have these currents of magma flowing everywhere. Maybe it's just dumb luck if it happens under the ice, you know, where we don't want it. Is that just a matter of chance where these flows come closest to the surface?
No, there's no chance, really. I wouldn't put it that way, I wouldn't call it dumb. It's because everything appears to be in cycles. And unfortunately, because the disciplines haven't been talking to each other, that now we see that the events that are happening today have happened many times before, so much so that it can be tracked. Now that we can use ice core samples and lake bottoms and tree rings, we can go back thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, sometimes millions of years, and we can now clearly see these cyclical events. What's harder to define is their cycles within cycles. So it's kind of hard to pinpoint, are we in a more recent cycle, a 1,000-year cycle, a 10,000-year cycle, a million-year cycle? That's where it gets a kind of challenging. But what's happening now, we've seen this as early as 26,000 years ago, or perhaps some would call it 41,000 years ago with the Little Ice Age. Going back even further than that, we often talk about the mammoth that we've seen at the North Pole. How could animals, prehistoric animals, live in these frozen areas? Because it wasn't frozen.
Right. Well, does that explain why this Lake Vostok has water? I mean, are there actual lakes underneath and around the ice in Antarctica?
Well, sure. In fact, I was glancing over an article that just came out today that they're finding water in the Earth's core. Are the outer core. So yes, there is water everywhere, more so than what was previously thought. How that plays, this is brand new, cutting edge. I could not tell you how water may play into this. I can tell you how the sun plays a role. I can tell you how magma, you know, the inner core, the outer core, I can tell you how that plays a role. Mm-hmm. But this new finding of water in the lower mantle, which how that can happen, I don't know, with such heat down there, does bring a new phenomena to what I call fluid displacement. Fluid displacement means when you add a fluid, not just water, but magma, oil, any kind of fluid, when you add a fluid to a surface, it moves. When you subtract a fluid, a liquid, from the surface, it contracts or expands. That, of course, plays into plate tectonics and earthquakes and volcanoes.
Okay, so it's the movement of a lot of different things in these cycles that contributes to the final outcome as we see it above the ground. Do you think that the sun has anything to do with it? You mentioned before when we were talking about the sun coming to its peak, its 11-year cycle.
That's correct. This is cycle 24. There's been 24 recorded cycles. Now, you know, there's millions of solar cycles, but often when you hear about these records, you know, broke a record here, broke a record there, really that's only going back to like 1880. So it doesn't go back very far when you hear about things being recorded or breaking a record. So the Earth has seen all of this many, many times before, and there is a direct causal effect between the sun and the Earth, really the solar system. So what's happening now in cycle 24, it's in its maximum. If you can visualize a bell curve, it would be the apex. It would be the top of the curve is where this cycle is right now. So this is when we would see generally the most activity. So in the last 72 hours, there's been a couple of X-class flares, a couple of M-class flares. Let's call it moderate or mediate. X would be more extreme. But it pales in comparison to the previous solar cycle, which was cycle 23. You know, we can get excited about an X1 in this cycle, but in cycle 23, there were numerous X-class flares, X-10, X-20, X-17, all the way to one day, November 3rd/4th of 2003, an X-45 flare occurred, which would have trumped the Carrington event, which happened in the 1800s, 1859, which lit telephone poles on fire.
Oh, yeah. Didn't it electrocute a guy, too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, everything went down.
Yeah.
Literally fire. Of course, they didn't have telephone wires like we have now, but they had
telegraph wires.
Yeah. And they literally caught on fire. It would be devastating if it occurred today.
Yeah.
It just so happened that the November 3rd/4th event was not Earth directed. It just had a partial glancing blow.
Yeah, we're lucky it wasn't pointed at us.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you said that there's a cycle 23 that was worse. Now, is this because they've only started counting these cycles, and they're up to 23?
Up to 24. That's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, is there any pattern within the pattern? In other words, is there a pattern to these different cycles as they collectively go up and down?
Yes. Good observation. It just so happens that during very active solar cycles that we have warming trends. The Earth warms up. During low solar cycles, such as 24, where we had I think it was 800 days of no sunspots, we have cooler temperatures. Now, that's where the big debate comes in with this global warming thing. So you hear in the news that record-breaking heat, 2012. Well, several times I've been on with George and over these events, and, because of my research and the books that I write, I historically researched these events, and there have been hotter temperatures far worse than today. In fact, there have been temperatures that reached 135 degrees.
Zoinks. So, okay, so what does the pattern within all of these different 11-year cycles tell us? Does it show that they themselves go up and down?
Absolutely.
Okay. How often?
Sure,
like, what's the, do we know what the turnover rate is, so to speak?
No. Well, not clearly, but you are tapping into something that's part of what these cyclical events. So yes, there are these cycles, but we can only go back so far. We're having to rely on these ice core samples, tree rings, lake bottom samples, which do tell us something. It tells us a lot.
Yeah.
It tells us when the Earth has been really hot and when it's been really cold. The challenging part is what cycle fits in where. That's you know who really had a handle on this were the Mayans, Egyptians as well, but many ancient tribes. They monitored the skies and they monitored the weather, and they knew of these sites. They were around so long, Rob. It wasn't until just the last two or three years that we acknowledge that man has been walking the Earth for at least 40,000 years. 3 or 4 years ago, if you said, the Egyptians, 10,000 years, that was the mark of the oldest, not civilized man, but communal man, someone with their knuckles dragging, but these were actual communities that go back at least 40,000 years. So when you have that much time to track these cycles, you get pretty accurate.
Right, and we know that they did that. A lot of different civilizations kept pretty good records, and it's funny how we're still learning from them. And what does it show? I mean, since we've been counting these 11-year cycles, has there been any range or any increase in anything steadily? Is something going up? Is something coming down? Is there anything that comes out of it?
Well, again, that goes back to the cycles. All we can see is geographically kind of a short tail. That we saw the cycle that we're in now looks very similar to the Ice Age cycle. And this, ironically, we're talking about ice melt in the Antarctic.
Yeah.
But at the very same time, there's an enormous amount of ice increase. And what's happening is where this all is going to is a magnetic reversal.
What's that?
There will actually be a flip,
and
we're into the latter years. Again, this is where the challenge is. It occurs about every several thousand years, but where in that cycle are we today? Well, research, all the documents that I come across are suggesting that people who are living today will probably witness in about 50 years, will probably witness the North Pole, the magnetic north, bounce down to the equator.
Right.
Now, that's before a full magnetic flip.
Okay.
So people will experience magnetic north bouncing around for a while before it finally makes a full total flip.
Okay, evidently is what happens when these things kick off. So let me ask you, right now, I mean, the North Pole is drifting around. Last I checked, it was somewhere in Canada. It'll probably be in Nova Scotia before too long.
It will. It's been moving about 40 miles a year. Good way to explain this is pilots, regulated pilots, not just commercial, but also the those that fly in their own community planes, that the FAA it's a mandate, a compulsory, that they had to recalibrate their instruments. Originally, once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have to recalibrate their instruments every 56 days.
Wow.
And I say it's not going to be long before they'll have to recalibrate their instruments every 28 days. That's how fast this thing is moving now.
Hmm. Yeah, we've heard about this. And, of course, this show is where I first learned about pole shift. And I think the general thinking was it was sort of headed towards something. And there are indicators that people point to. And do you think that there is going to be any type of explanation about what is going on, you know, with the poles? What's going on with either this planet's getting warmer or it's not? Is there ever going to be a consensus?
That's a good question. That goes back to the left hand, right hand. And I'm pleased at what I'm seeing. I think it's going in the right direction. You know, as much as I hate to make this comparison, but unfortunately, politics have got into the scientific field, and it, in my opinion, it seems to have really capped itself at this global warming thing, and now it's hard to find the truth of what's going on. But having said that, I'm really seeing as I, monitor these things on a daily basis, and I have connections inside of NASA, inside of NOAA, inside the European Space Agency. So I really have my finger on the pulse. That I don't know how long it will take, but it is definitely going in the right direction. But that may be, the year 2020 maybe, where both all disciplines, biological, space, Earth, will come together and have some pretty accurate forecasting.
Yeah, well, no, it seems to get better and better all the time. I want to talk to you a little bit more about the sun. I know there's a lot of videos that I keep seeing coming across my desk where the sun's doing this and it's shooting out these flares. And I'm always surprised when people make a big deal of it, because I know the people putting these things out are scientists, like from NASA. But just to get a straight answer, is the sun doing things that are unexpected and never before seen and potentially, disruptive? Or has this stuff been happening ever since we've been looking at it?
I can't give a yes or no answer to that. It's kind of somewhere in the middle.
Yes, usually is.
We are definitely witnessing things we've never seen before, because of the short lifespan of our technology.
Uh-huh.
For example, solar cycle 23, never witnessed an X45 before.
Huh.
So yes, that's true. In cycle 24, some scientific communities kind of expanding what's really happening?
Uh-huh.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
They everybody needs funding. So when something like Cycle 24 comes along,
uh-huh.
there's a lot of scientists and colleagues that are dependent on getting finance.
Yeah, and to do that, they have to sort of put this thing out in a certain way and color it and shade it a certain way. I know it is just part and process of trying to figure out what's going on, but we're here and we're going to keep doing it. You're listening to Coast AM. Your phone calls for Mitch Batchelor, some Earth Changes TV right after the break. Coming up at 11, Daniel Pinchbeck. That's going to be one not to miss. You're on Coast to Coast AM. Yeah, we are back. Thanks for joining us here, Coast to Coast AM. And, well, we're right in the middle of it, right in the middle of the beginning of it. We're talking with Mitch Batchelor from Earth Changes TV. And he's bringing up a lot of interesting points about these ancient civilizations and how they started to gather information about the weather. And, you know, I think that's a sign of what they thought about what was important to make note of. And we find ourselves doing the same thing. And I just wonder who was able to derive more information out of it. Maybe the Mayans, in all their diligence, managed to pull something out that was more useful or practical or meaningful just by using their intuition, just by using their, you know, non-rational scientific mind. And then on the other hand, we're doing it the scientific fashion here in the Western world, 2014. And I wonder if, well, if we're better off for all our instruments. I wonder if there's a part of our brain that we shouldn't be tapping into when it comes to these complicated systems, these systems that have so many variables we couldn't begin to understand it rationally. I mean, to figure it out. So I wonder if that's not a good sign to maybe use a different part of the brain altogether. Well, your questions and maybe a couple more of mine are going to help me figure that out. And coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to be talking with Daniel Pinchbeck, and he is someone you're not going to want to miss. Author, writer for Rolling Stone magazine. And he is broaching all kinds of very interesting things. He's got a think tank, the Center for Planetary Culture. He's going to discuss this world, post-carbon civilization, psychedelic renaissance, and a whole lot more. You're going to want to miss this because we're going to get into some future thought that is going to be worthwhile. And, of course, your phone calls as well right after the break. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with Mitch Batchelor from Earth Changes TV about this volcanic activity underneath Antarctica, and also about these ancient civilizations who have their own take on weather, really their own relationship to the weather. But Mitch, I have to hand it to you. Actually, I got to give you props because the way you answered those questions in the last half hour, I was asking some pretty tough ones. And if you had come up with an easy yes or no, it really wouldn't have rung true, because when you're dealing with such a complex set of systems here, there really is no definitive answer to most of these big questions. So I want to say I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, that shows you are a very thorough thinker.
Well, thank you. I started Earth Changes TV in 1995. So that's when it all started. In 1997, I switched from TV to radio. I was doing a simulcast through the internet, and I've since changed the name to Earth Changes Media.
Okay.
And in my first book, Solar Rain, was in 2005, and my second book, Global Warming, a Disguise, was in 2007. My third book, which will complete a three book series.
Uh-huh.
Is following what the research is telling us,
okay,
which takes us beyond the sun to the Milky Way, to our galaxy. So this kind of answers a question you had before: where is this all leading? And it's leading to our Milky Way. We're getting pretty good, because of the instruments we have, ironically, the Mayans without instruments other than their eyes and observation and know what they call light pollution because there were no lights, were, and their ability, you see, one of the things that we've learned through archaeology is that coming out of Africa, first of all, we've been around a lot longer than most people thought. Some trace it back 100,000 years. And now there's hard evidence of that there has been trade communication from the Middle East, which is, you know, northern Africa,
yep.
and South America.
Okay.
Now, how that could happen is that the continents were there wasn't always oceans between the continents.
Yeah, there's a land bridge between Asia and Australia, wasn't there?
Well, that's right. Plus, they're also finding out that they had some vessels. Some forms of ships that were able to travel. But the bottom line is that there's been communication between what we would consider ancient Egypt, so to speak, with South America. Hmm. So it is the sharing of this information over thousands of years, perhaps touching 100,000 years, both observing the sky which funnels to the Milky Way. Now, with the instruments we have in space, we're able to start to track the cycles of the Milky Way, and what occurs on the Milky Way, we're starting to see what the outcome is to our solar system. Will we ever get there? I don't know. Should we even try to understand it? Good question.
Well, okay. Are you saying that there's some sort of correlation between weather patterns and constellations? Or is there a more physical force that comes from, as you say, the galactic center that's causing some things?
Well, I try to refrain from using the galactic center because that is a term that's often associated with spaceships and stuff. I'm not ruling that out. I'm not ruling out. I would love to be able I have an open mind. Let's keep it that way.
No, actually, I was referring to the fact that there's a massive black hole there, and who knows else.
Yes,
there is some sort of, you know, energy exchange.
There is.
Yeah, that's
there
what
is,
I meant.
There
yeah.
is. There is. There is. And not only that there is, but it is funneled. What I'm talking about is charged particles. I'm going to try and speak in easy terms. It's called charged particles. Now, charged particles come in many ways. The most common and the smallest, and unfortunately the most harmful, is called the galactic cosmic ray, sometimes just known as cosmic rays. That does come directly from our Milky Way. It also comes from other forms of like pulsars and so forth, quasars. The second form is gamma rays. Gamma ray, which is a radiation, which, as we all know, can be extremely harmful. And I'm talking about a spectrum. So the gamma rays, a little larger, is larger than the cosmic ray. And then the largest of these charged particles is the solar ray, solar flares and CMEs. So what's happening now is that there is evidence that there's a large amount of charged particles funneled. That's the important part, that it's actually funneled. If you can visualize kind of a tornado-like funnel thing,
sure.
That's coming from the Milky Way.
Okay, so it's sort of concentrated.
Concentrated,
right.
Thank you. That works.
And then hitting the Earth, and then what happens after it does that?
It heats up the inner core. It heats up the Earth's core.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
And one thing I wanted to add to that, I do want to circle back to the Earth's core.
Yeah.
But to better complete this idea of cycle 23 and 24, cycle 23 was much larger, devastating. As many as 200 sunspots a day, you know, in a single day. Today, we count 5, 6. But here's the big difference. The Earth's magnetic field has weakened significantly just in the last 20 years. So what an X-class flare could do in cycle 23, a large C-class or M-class flare could do today.
Right.
That's a big difference, and that's what's missing right now in the news, is that although cycle 24 is much smaller, but you have to factor in that the Earth's magnetic field is much weaker. So the effect of these cosmic rays hitting the Earth has is far more significant than it has been previously.
Yeah.
Maybe than the last 100,000, 200,000 years.
Yeah. And when you're talking about cycles, of course, you're talking about the last recorded 11-year cycle of the sun.
Yes.
To people who have just tuned in. Yeah, well, that is significant. That is, let me ask you this question, too, just because we touched upon it earlier, and you have a pretty open mind. When you look into what the ancient civilizations were doing, you mentioned the Mayans and their meticulous fascination with the weather. What do you think they pulled out of it? Do you think they were able to decipher the weather or somehow get a better notion of it or have a better relationship with it than we now do with all our sophisticated toys?
We may be catching up to them with our super, futuristic toys. Yes. We may be catching up to them, but can you imagine doing this without the instruments we have today? Were they accurate? They were so accurate that they would build these huge buildings so accurate that when the summer solstice would hit, it would hit the exact 4-inch square. would say yes. They had a pretty good sense of seasonal and weather patterns. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it became part of them, and I'm sure that was a big deal. I mean, when you're in touch with your environment, I think that leads to a greater understanding. Let's jump into a phone call real quick. A wild card line. We got Joe that's holding in Cypress, Texas. Welcome, Joe.
Mitch, have you heard any reports on what the Russians found when they drilled into Lake Vostok?
No.
Ah, okay. They finally drilled through 2 miles, 4,000 meters of ice in January of 2013. It took them 2 years to do it. They recorded the lowest temperature ever recorded on Earth of minus 89.2 centigrade. They extracted water samples, and last July, Russia Today had a news article, and they said that they found 3,500 unique gene sequences in that water, and the bottom of the ice layer is over 15 million years old, so sealed underneath there. And I can explain where that groundwater is coming from. When you take uranium and thorium atoms and you split them in under fission, which comes from the cosmic rays hitting those big atoms, and we've got over 2 million cubic miles of that fissionable material, the protons and neutrons are matter that is never destroyed. But when you break them apart, you get new elemental atoms, and some of those are hydrogen, some of them are oxygen, some of them are carbon. And not only do we form carbon dioxide and water and petroleum, and as a result of this process, but we also have an enormous amount of heat. And all of that's vented out through the seafloor vents. I've got a series of articles at my website starting back in 2009 with the motive force for bulk climate change.
Mm-hmm. Jill, what is that reference you made earlier to they found these different strands of DNA?
That is Russia Today.
Okay. Do you know what they were talking about, like fish, marine animals, things like that?
Yes. They said that out of these 3,500 sequences, they had several thousand single-cell bacteria, but they said they also had multi-cell. And I haven't followed the story up since last summer.
Right.
I intended to, but I apologize.
Yeah.
The simplest life form and the most diverse life form on the planet is called Archaea, A-R-C-H-E-A. Those are so different from bacteria that they were given a separate family genesis in the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
They are the single cell animals that live in termites and cattle and produce methane, but they also live at seafloor vents under enormous pressure, 7,000 feet deep, and temperatures as high as 2,500 degrees, where they digest methane.
Mm-hmm.
So here is a life form that's completely, and they are the only life form on the planet that's completely independent of photosynthesis.
Interesting. Okay.
I've got a lot of this.
Yeah, there's Lake Vostok, to me, has always been the most interesting place in the world. It was 10 years ago that Bob Dean, the legendary ufologist, whispered in my ear one day, 10 years ago. He said, Lake Vostok, you just keep your eye on that. And gosh darn it, if that guy wasn't right. What's your takeaway from that, Mitch?
Well, it sounds like that latest article I was telling you about related to water. And that's an area that I'm not as familiar with. I think it's something new, but it does highlight, the caller does highlight one point about bridging these gaps between all the disciplines. Earlier I'd mentioned biologists. So now we have biologists coming into the picture, which is absolutely fantastic for us. So we have the physicists, we have space scientists, we have atmospheric scientists and an ocean scientist all coming together to put this picture together. I think what may come out of all this is simply the age of the Earth and how it began. Mm-hmm. It's much thought that these asteroids, comets, which I believe to be the same. I believe an asteroid is simply a gassed out comet. May have brought these life forms that he's speaking of to Earth. So I think what's going to match in bringing this together is that the solar system is more connected perhaps than we thought. And I think
biologically, you mean?
Yes, biologically.
Yeah. Right, because all the building blocks that made us are flying around everywhere else.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's true. I think they might dig up an asteroid or two in our future. Who knows where? Who knows? Yeah, when it started leaching into the system, there's all kinds of new alien life forms being spawned every day. Well, let's go to a regular life form in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Dana, you're on the wild card line.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, I have a $64,000 question for Mitch, but I just want to say, I just want to tell you what I know so you know why I'm asking you this, Mitch. Number one, this is about climate change. You said we're headed in the right direction, but couple years back, East Anglia University in England had that horrific scandal where emails leaked out that they deliberately fudged that, the climate change information to produce the desired results. Those emails were never supposed to leak out. That was a huge scandal and a black eye for the university. That's the first thing. The second thing is, the models that they're using to produce the desired results to prove climate change are faulty models, and they're feeding faulty data. That's number two. And the third thing, NASA as a whole, but specifically scientists that have worked on this supposed climate change, are funded by, the administration, by Congress. And if Obama wants to push climate change, that's exactly what the NASA scientists are going to produce, because they live and die by, these grants that they get from the government.
Right. We talked about that earlier. Yeah.
Right.
And what is the $64 question?
Scientists were fired from NASA.
Okay. Well, what is the $64 question?
Okay. Here it is, Mitch. If they are so dead set on this climate change, why do these scientists and others refuse to have an open televised debate about their opposition? They will not face their opposition in a debate.
Hmm.
Could you answer me why they won't do that? Because you're open-minded, so I'm hoping to get a good answer from you.
What about that, Mitch?
Well, I have the privilege of being open-minded because I have no vested interest. I'm not ruled by any committee. I don't have the things that a typical scientist who goes through your procedures academically has at risk. So I have that freedom. In fact, people often refer to me as the Bob Woodward of the science community. Bob Woodward, as we know, the deep voice. He was never a politician, but he had all the scoop on all of them. He knew them all, and he knew what the inside story was. Well, that's me. What she had to say, I have no argument with. She's right.
Debate is good. Debate,
follow the money.
Well, a debate clears the air. It's the It's the sunshine.
Yeah. I mean, look, I have gone head-to-head with these guys, Michael Mann, and it started with Al Gore. Al Gore bought into it, and they just made a lot of mistakes. Here's what's missing, Rob.
You have to hold it there. I think we all agree that more debate is needed. But, Mitch, thanks for coming on and talking about some of these very interesting subjects. It really shows that we're all connected by the weather. That's the bottom line. Well, stay with us. Right after the break, we are going to be talking with Daniel Pinchbeck about his new think tank project, the Center for Planetary Culture, and his vision and his work developing a transition plan to a post-carbon civilization. It's all going to come together. We're going to get into a lot more stuff, too, and your phone calls. Stay right there. We're coming right back. This is Coast to Coast AM.